The Most Unlikely Looking Pair, 1954-59. Evelyn Skinner, last seen in 1944 outside the modest albergo, was alive and well and positively thriving, something she would put down to cold water swimming and a daily dose of cod liver oil. She had, by 1954, long resumed her part-time teaching post at the Slade School of Art and had happily swapped weekdays in Kent for her studio flat in Bloomsbury, although the county had her back most weekends. She was 73 years old and looked 10 years younger. Her mind was agile and her curiosity as keen as ever. She was a favourite with the teaching fraternity, and her students adored her. She brought them to art in a way no one else had so far done.
"No, Mr. Fitzgibbon, that's not quite right. Goya picks up after Velázquez and runs with it. Mr. Gunnerslake, Rome is the capital of all these 18th century meetings, and Rubens in Rome changed everything. I'd also like to add, Miss Shaw, that there is an immediacy to art. One finds oneself abruptly in front of a moment of ecstasy. This is where art is effective. Art captures permanently."
At the end of every term, she took lunch with her students at Beppi's Cafe, a short stroll away. 11 of them took over the back four tables, Evelyn positioned as centrally as such an arrangement would allow. They ate the daily special, usually a plate of pasta cooked by Beppi's mother, washed down with cups of strong tea.
"Look in here," said Evelyn, dabbing her lips with a paper serviette. "Look about you. It's so harmonious," she said. "This could be a painting. Crimson and cream stripes and wood, everyone dressed in monochrome attire. Good manners and joy abound. Lunch and friendship. Perfection, I say." And she raised her cup of tea. "Incipit vita nova," she said.
"So begins a new life." When Evelyn had returned from war, life had been far from harmonious. She had been gripped by a startling loneliness that had propelled her to Battersea Dogs Home, from where she'd adopted an old overweight basset called Barry. Or he adopted her, wasn't that how it went? But she always liked to tell the story as if it was a limerick.
"There once was a basset from Battersea who met an old deer from Bloomsbury."
He was a wonderful companion for 5 years. Unashamedly lazy, he required little exercise to uphold his cynical nature. His modus operandi was to sit in front of the fire and drink condensed milk with whiskey in it. He used to accompany her to the odd evening of attribution and liked to break wind when he was ready to leave, behaviour Evelyn told her friends she too would eventually adopt. They were good for one another. They were happy years. In her classroom at the Slade, he'd sleep on a blanket under the desk as slides of the High Renaissance sequenced above him. He died peacefully during a long and tedious talk on Giorgio Vasari. Evelyn was surprised Moore hadn't succumbed.
"It wasn't one of my best," she said.
Midway through, even she had felt for a pulse. An afternoon at the end of March saw Evelyn standing at the front of her class. She cut a dashing figure in pale blue linen slacks and white blouse.
"Oh, no, no," she said. "Michelangelo was an earthquake. He broke into mannerism with his poses, quite fey, really. Deeply irritating because we know so much of his personality. We still manoeuvre in the architecture of Vasari's lives. Vasari would have been delighted, of course, that sort of man."
Her students were enraptured, their faces lit by the slide screen behind her.
"So," she said, drawing out the vowel, "we were where?"
She had done it again, had veered so spectacularly away from Piero della Francesca's The Baptism of Christ that she glanced over to the door to make sure Bill Coldstream wasn't hovering. She looked at her watch,
curtailed once again by the scythe of time. "I must let you go, my dear ladies and gentlemen, but to recap, the mathematical foundations of beauty and harmony, Piero's love of geometry, his unique style within the early Renaissance. The holy moment is also the tentative moment. A very good end of term to you all. Go forth, go learn, go love.
The lights came on, and Jesus disappeared, and an excited revelry rose from the class. Books were flung into bags and chairs scraped as students moved towards the door. "Goodbye, Miss Skinner," echoed into the corridor.
"Goodbye," said Evelyn. "You too, my dear. I suggest you look up Roberto Longhi or Carlo Ludovico Raggianti."
"Oh, yes, yes. I hope so," she said.
"Thank you, Mr. Cornwallis. I shall try indeed. Goodbye."
And then there was quiet. And it was exquisite. She closed her eyes and acknowledged the end of term with yogic breathing. After a good 5 minutes, the presence of another infused the air. She opened her eyes, happy to see Jem Gunnerslake still at his desk, him of the unruly hair and courtly manners.
"Jem," she said,
first names for people she liked.
"Miss Skinner,
are you all right?"
"I am," he said, and stood up. "I've something for you," he said. "I found it in a shop on Charing Cross Road. I know how much she meant to you."
Evelyn took the brown paper bag from his hand. Inside was a burgundy cloth-covered book, with Niente, nothing, in gold lettering down the spine.
"First edition," he added.
"Oh, my, this is so wonderful," she said,
and she flicked through the pages till she stopped at a poem, one about trams and lights on the Arno and sand diggers. And she became 21 again, about to embark on a love affair with a city that would last a lifetime. She ran her fingers across Constance Everly's fading name and said,
"Such was her influence on me, Jem."
"As yours is on us, Miss Skinner."
Jem looked at her and smiled. He didn't often smile, on account of his bad teeth.
"Well, I shall treasure this," said Evelyn, hugging the book to her chest. "I lost my own copy on a train down to Rome. A sumptuous find for a fellow traveller, I thought then."
"And now?"
"Careless and distracted by first love. You know how it is."
But Jem Gunnerslake didn't. First love would have to wait. They left the classroom together, and on the stone stairs encountered a rare sighting of the artist du jour and occasional tutor.
"Good evening, Lucien," said Evelyn. "Are you well?"
"Oh, yes, Miss Skinner,"
and he dashed past in a fervour. When he was out of earshot, Evelyn said,
"He's quite the ladies' man, I've heard. Bit of a menace."
"Have you read The Interpretation of Dreams?" asked Jem.
"Indeed I have," said Evelyn. "During that first trip to Florence, my friend Mr. Collins recommended that I should. We were seated in the Piazza della Signoria. I really do remember it so well, drinking vermouth, that was my drink at the time, discussing Gian Bologna's Sabine Woman. And I remember quite distinctly how he said that book was the way forward."
Evelyn stopped by the front door. She said,
"The church does not have a language for the variations of our humanness. We need to look at Freud for that. Psychoanalysis is the way forward. That's what he said to me, Jem, and I do believe he was right. I read the first English translation."
They left behind the comforting stink of linseed oil and stepped outside. There was an herbaceous hook to the spring air, the slow roll of a lawnmower moving methodically across the quad. It was the season of blossom and leaf growth, and the bare branches appeared bewildered by the vibrancy of emerging livery. A wolf whistle pierced the air.
"Not for me, Mr. Gunnerslake. That is the call of the young."
Jem looked about. But then a rather handsome middle-aged woman emerged from behind a tree and caused Evelyn to wave.
"Good God," said Jem. "Is that who I think it is?"
"Yes," said Evelyn. "It is."
Dorothy Dotty Cunningham, the renowned abstract artist. The circles of art tend to overlap, as do the circles of literature, and Dotty and Evelyn had met over 30 years previously through Evelyn's painter father, H.W. Skinner, and his mistress muse at the time, Gabriella Quarteth. Old enough to be Dotty's mother, Evelyn guided her young protégé through the fast-flowing tributaries of lesbian life. Never lovers, but always friends, they said on that first meeting,
I feel as if I've known you forever. A lifetime later, it was as if they had.
Dotty was leaning against the tree, cross-armed with a cheeky tilt of the head, a pose that meant, tell me more, or take your clothes off, depending on the circumstance and time of day. She was as famous for her masculine garb and short hair as she was for her painting. That afternoon she sported worn corduroy trousers, a billowing linen shirt, and the kind of rakish polka-dot neckerchief most often associated with farm workers at harvest time. Dotty, ironically, hated the country. Hampstead Heath, for her, was the middle of nowhere.
"Ready for a swim, darling," she called out to Evelyn.
"Ready as ever," said Evelyn.
They embraced familiarly, and when they moved apart, Jem Gunnerslake popped up between them, telling Dotty how much he admired her work. He delivered a swift and wholly competent critique of three of Dotty's most famous pieces, Journeywoman, Maria, and Arrested Time. Dotty thanked him and ran her fingers through her hair, her nail beds coloured by the remnants of her latest work. "I look forward to seeing you again," he said, with the confidence of a middle-aged man about to embark on his first affair.
"Have a good break, Miss Skinner."
"You too, Jem, and thank you," she said, holding up the brown paper bag that contained her book.
They watched him disappear out of the gates towards the underground station, towards a train to Northumberland, where he would spend a week pruning his mother's bay tree. Dotty looked at her friend quizzically.
"Jem Gunnerslake," said Evelyn. "Lost soul, but incredibly kind. Last to the lifeboats kind of man. I like him a lot. I could imagine him veering away from art and studying medicine."
"That's quite a leap,
though Leonardo was halfway there."
"He also indulges my stories from the past."
"We all do, darling," said Dotty, reaching for her arm.
"Come on," she said. "Let's get wet."
They found a taxicab on Gower Street, and the effusiveness of first greeting settled into a calm précis of the weeks since they'd last met.
"Gunnerslake," said Dotty. "Not related to that American theatre critic, is he?"
"Who?"
"Jem. She's not his mother, is she?"
"Is who his mother?"
"Penelope. They look similar." "I have no idea who you're talking about."
"You do. Penelope Gunnerslake. We went to see that play."
"What play?"
"In the West End, about 4 years ago. Charlie took us."
"Wetherall?"
"Yes, Charlie Wetherall took us to see that play where the frontier pianist with a drink problem stole the show."
"Oh, God, yes. A small but noticeable part. He was marvellous. So real." "Well, Penelope Gunnerslake was the woman we were sitting next to," said Dotty.
"The redhead with pearls?"
"The redhead with pearls," said Dotty.
The air cooled as they drove into the shaded encampment of NW3.
"Nearly there," said Evelyn.
"She wore them in bed, you know, those pearls."
"The theatre critic did?"
"I told you at the time."
"You most certainly did not," said Evelyn,
and she opened her bag and took out her purse. She turned to Dotty and said,
"Did she review you, my darling?"
"She was quite complimentary, actually," said Dotty. The taxi came to a halt on Highgate West Hill. Evelyn paid and closed the door.
"She didn't say the grand flourish at the end could little make up for a lacklustre opening," said Evelyn.
"Oh, very good," laughed Dotty.
"Impetus lost in the second act."
"I'm glad you're enjoying yourself," said Dotty.
"Oh, I am," said Evelyn. "Three curtain calls were too many."
They cut through to the edge of the heath and walked the hardened path towards the gate, the vegetation pungent beside them in the balmy afternoon heat.
"I went to the colony last night," said Dotty. "Muriel says hello."
"Ah, Muriel," said Evelyn fondly.
They settled their belongings in the meadow adjacent to the water and went to the hut to change. Evelyn emerged in her trusty black costume with shorts and readjusted the strap on her shoulder. Her body had changed little over the years, except for the band of padding around her middle, an accumulation of the 6 o'clock cocktail, a ritual as accurate at keeping time as Big Ben. Dotty's costume, in comparison, was
Well, a bit circus. It gets the job done, she said. They walked gingerly across the wet decking and dumped their towels by the steps. Dottie limbered up before getting into the water, as she always did. She stretched her arms across her chest and warmed up her thighs with a good slap. Dottie nudged Evelyn to follow her gaze. A woman was by the edge of the water, showing signs of indecision. Dottie had long believed there was a direct correlation between how one entered the ponds and how one had sex.
Utter nonsense, said Evelyn. I usually hold my nose and fall in.
Case in point, said Dottie, before performing an elegant swallow dive with minimal splash. The familiar cold rush hit Evelyn. 13 degrees against the high 20s of the air, the inner gasp and the letting go. She swam eye level to the green water, as clouds were bothered by the breeze and wavelets crested by sunlight. These were Evelyn's favourite days, her spring awakening. Past the water lilies again and the bulrushes. Dappled light on overhanging tree trunks brought motion to the static monsters and willows draped low to meet their vivid reflection. She breathed steadily through her nose and the ducks matched the ponderous ease of her breaststroke. A heron took off majestically from the bank and flew low across her path. She was in heaven. A group of 20-somethings with sunglasses and red lips gathered on the pontoon, looking as if they might be a synchronized swimming team. What joy their presence brought. When Dottie caught sight of them, Evelyn knew she would double back and swoon at their entry, which she did. That they all dived in together caused Dottie to look over at Evelyn and raise her eyebrows. Oh, Dottie, plus ça change. Evelyn climbed out, thankful that the muscles in her arms still had some grip. She picked up her towel and draped it across her shoulders, walked back carefully across the dirt to the grass, and let the sun dry her. She lay down with blackbird song and wood pigeon call and bees in clover. She thought all of existence in this bucolic trance was a poem, timeless, resolute, universal. The image would be repeated over the decades, women seeking solace, a safe place, bodies unclothed and held by nature. All the women she'd ever cared about had come with her here at some time or another. Not Livia, of course, that beautiful flyaway puffball who deposited the seeds of first love across her life. She'd first come here with Constance when the ponds had officially opened. She'd been 45, Constance well into her 70s, probably the same age, thought Evelyn, as she was now. By then, Constance had had mild success with her collection of poems entitled Everything, the sequel to Nothing. The third collection, Something, would never emerge. She suffered a heart attack on the Gotthard Railway on what would have been her final trip to Florence. Crossing the Kestellenbach Viaduct was often cited as taking one's breath away, and it did exactly that. They found her with a pen in her hand, final thoughts on love, ultimately. I shall remain astonished. She had a militant following of women who wanted to put this line on her gravestone once they'd got permission to have her buried in the English cemetery in Florence, as close to Barrett Browning as they could get. Of course, neither happened. Only Evelyn knew of the final wishes. Cremation, an early morning boat ride on the Arno with one of the Renaioli, the sand diggers. Sunlight, haze, memories. She was poured onto the sleepy reflection of a palazzo, not a ripple, at one, at peace, her home. Evelyn looked up and shielded her eyes against the sun. Dottie waved as she came towards her. Dottie looked a trifle pensive. Sundowner, darling, she said.
Is it that time already? Said Evelyn, reaching for her watch.
Clock's running a tad fast.
Okay, I'll go and change.
The gods sent a chariot to Highgate West Hill, a black Austin FX3 that sped south until the green gave way to the white fringes of Bloomsbury and the red brick mansion blocks of Fitzrovia. Evelyn had noticed all afternoon there was something troubling Dottie.
She raised Dottie's hand and kissed it.
What's on your mind, my love?
Dottie sighed. My paint has turned against me again. I'm allergic.
Which one?
Titanium white. Always the troublemaker. Left me rather defeated, Linny.
Oh, Dottie.
They crossed Oxford Street into Soho Square as the bells of St. Patrick's greeted them. Actors headed towards Shaftesbury Avenue, and prostitutes were taking an early evening stroll before work laid them out for the night. The smell of coffee crept in through the window, and the clatter of vegetable trolleys rushing towards steamy kitchen doors. Italians and Maltese were smoking outside cafes, as music from jukeboxes brought life to their toes. Queer identity hid itself in the shadows of these dark streets, and both women had, at some time, left an imprint of their body upon some unfamiliar bed, an addendum of promises made for a lifetime but meant only for a night. The cab turned into Dean Street and pulled up outside Leone's Quo Vadis. The restaurant was half an hour from opening, but the manager recognized the broad smiles of his regular patrons and opened the door and greeted them. He seated them at the best table over by the wall of paintings, where they could freely observe everyone who entered. 5 minutes later, a tray of Negronis and a bowl of olives was heading their way. Evelyn stood up and said, "My darling man, what a sight you are."
"This'll put hairs on your chest," the barman said in his soft Celtic lilt.
"Here's hoping," said Dottie, reaching for a drink, as if her talent depended on it. The women toasted one another, and before sitting back down, Dottie took out her glasses and scrutinized one of the paintings above their table. She said to Evelyn, "I captured you, didn't I?
Who you were then, who you were becoming.
I count this portrait as my one true success."
"Have there not been others?"
"Not like this," said Dottie, lifting it off the wall. "Not like this." It had been painted the summer after they first met. 1924, maybe. A forlorn study of Evelyn shipwrecked on a Roman pillow. Heart sore, facing the viewer. White dress, white sheets, glistening sun-bronzed face. Her hands shadowing her eyes against the dazzling glare. Dottie had painted sunlight straight from the tube.
"Why was I so sad?" asked Evelyn. "Do you remember?"
"Livia?"
"Oh, no. Livia was long gone. How strange the heart." "Listen to this," said Dottie.
On the back of the canvas, she had written a description of the day, which she read out loud. Soundscape. Bells. The squeal of swifts. Aunt Maria reciting the rosary. Time, mid-morning. Weather. Sun blazing, no respite, no cloud. Gasping. They'd been staying with Evelyn's Italian aunt, whose chronic ill health, celibacy and wealth had guaranteed an unbroken connection with the Catholic Church. She had God's ear day and night. She also had a beautiful villa with high walls away from the gaze of the city. Because of this, Aunt Maria had long been a favoured destination for both women until her slow decline and eventual death in the winter of 1943. It had been Evelyn who had closed the old woman's eyes. The villa was bequeathed, unsurprisingly, to a cloistered sect of nuns, which Dottie found highly erotic. The undervalued and wrongly attributed collection of still-life paintings went to Evelyn. "At least you got the family fruit," Dottie wrote at the time.
"Tell me again why you spent the duration of the war in Italy," said Dottie, finishing her Negroni.
Evelyn's absence from wartime London was her go-to tease.
"I was taking care of my aunt," said Evelyn. "I've told you countless times, you shameless woman, I go where I'm needed, always have, the result of being brought up by an ailing, critical mother."
"You were brought up by your father."
"She was a short umbilical drive away."
"Spy," said Dottie, grinning.
"Lot of bunkum."
"Spy, spy, spy," said Dottie, pleased with herself, ordering another round of cocktails.
"Spy,"
she mouthed, and made her hand into a gun, and shot the bread basket. The two women were woefully underdressed for dinner, a and carried a faint whiff of pond. But their intention to leave was thwarted by Peppino, the owner, who insisted they stay by uncorking a saucy bottle of Bardolino and whispering tasty suggestions from the kitchen. When he left, Evelyn said,
"Do I look as tipsy as I feel?"
"No point asking me, dear," said Dotty. "I've been talking to two of you for the last hour. Cheers, sweets."
They were eyed suspiciously, of course, by pre-theatre diners, until word got round who Dotty was. Her notoriety eclipsed any interest in the chef's specials, and women in their elegance and pearls were the ones eager to catch Dotty's eye, presenting themselves as the next muse, the next subject for a canvas, the next conquest. Dotty inhaled the attention, especially now there was space. "I've left her," she said, plopping an olive in her mouth.
"Ah, I was wondering," said Evelyn, exhaling loudly.
Caroline Beaver Candy was the woman in question. Not a real name, obviously, because Dotty was too discreet to reveal the identities of all her paramours. But the story followed an ever-familiar pattern, that of Dotty's penchant for young married women. The subterfuge gave a much-needed energy boost to the post-menopausal hinterland of creative repetition. No matter what protestations Dotty made about the difference in age, often significant, she invariably fell in love with love and the inspiration it brought. To see a beautiful woman writhe in climax beneath her made her incredibly productive, and canvas after canvas shot through the Cork Street coffers in those early days of lust. Evelyn often wondered if the gallery itself procured prospective lovers for her friend, a guarantee against the artistic equivalent of writer's block. It usually took 6 months for needy husbands and colicky children to become the inevitable reality, like the first leaf fall in September's sultry yawn. Rose tint gave way to Prussian green or blue-black, and large seascapes of doom were painted over, limbs with summer sweat. Dotty looked again at the portrait of her friend.
"I've never painted so well," she said before replacing the painting on the wall. She downed a glass of grappa as if it was water and proceeded to deflate like a ruptured lung. Evelyn knew what she needed to do, and she knew she was the only one who could do it. She reached across the table and grasped Dotty's hands. She said, "How about Florence?" Glassy-eyed and a bit drunk, Dotty said, "Would I like her?"